Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I am Jason Henricks, and I will be your host today as we discuss aging. All the digital attention seems focused on millennials, but the aging population has unique needs that fintech can help solve. In fact, fintech for the aging population might be the secret weapon for incumbents to deepen their relationships with those existing customers. I'm joined in the first segment by show regular Theodora Lau and her partner at Unconventional Ventures, Brad Limer, to talk about why innovators shouldn't overlook the aging population. And in the second half, we'll talk with two startups that are working to solve issues in this segment. Today's show is brought to you by Fintech Forge, a company J.P. Nichols and I founded to help banks build and extend their innovation capacity in a way that drives real results fast. You don't need to create a lab or an incubator to be innovative. Our proprietary FIRE methodology, which stands for Fast, Iterative, Responsive Experiments, allows institutions to move fast, promote learning, all while balancing risk. Want to learn more? Check out our site at ftforge.com, or if you'll be at BAI, we'll be hosting a three-hour workshop covering the topic. A couple of announcements before we get started. Block Show by Cointelegraph will be holding their first North American show in Las Vegas, August 20th to 21st. Use the code 20BREAKINGBANKS when you register at blockshow.com to get a 20% discount. The Mobile Payments Conference 2018 will be August 22nd to 24th right here in Chicago where I am. Register using the code MPC18100 to receive $100 off. Again, that's MPC18100 to receive $100 off. August 28th and 29th is the AI and Banking Virtual Summit, a free online event where you'll get the chance to learn from leading industry experts on how to prepare and successfully leverage AI in your financial institution. Learn more at abe.ai. Finovate Fall is in New York, September 24th to the 27th. Use the code BREAKINGBANKS20 to get 20% off. Last, BAI Beacon is one of the largest banking-specific shows drawing an international crowd to listen to over 1,000 speakers and participate in 75 workshops, just like our FIRE workshop. Jim Marouche, JP, and I will both be there, and JP is, in fact, emceeing the Global Innovation Awards. That is BAI Beacon, October 9th to 11th in Orlando, Florida. Get $400 off when you use the code B04. Have something you want to share with our audience? Hit us on Twitter at BreakingBanks1 or email us at info@provoke.fm. Theo and Brad, welcome to the show. Glad that we can attack an issue that I know we're all very passionate about and have been talking about, the one of aging, and not just anti-aging and what we're trying to do to avoid it, but where does fintech fit within this? And so much attention is paid on the millennials and the digital native, but when we talk about the aging population, are they the digital deadbeats? You know, Theo, you've spent probably the most time given what you were doing with AARP before this, you know, when you think of the aging population, why are you so excited about it as an area that innovators should be focused?
So I think, you know, first and foremost, the one thing that we don't often think about is the minute that you're born, we're all getting older, right? So unless we have any, you know, specific tricks that we are hiding, the fact of the matter is, you know, the day you're born, we are getting older. So we're marching towards the same destiny, if you will. And just from a, you know, visual perspective, right, 10,000 people a day turn 65. And so if you think about 2 days from now, you will have 20,000 people that turn 65. And that is enough amount of people that fills the SAP Center or that fills the Verizon Center. And so if you think about it, just the sheer mass of people that are getting older, but the way you know that we are getting older is different, right? You know, a 50-year-old today is different than a 50-year-old 20 years ago. And we're living longer, we're more productive. And so, you know, the sheer economy of scale, $7.6 trillion that they spend on an annual basis, that alone should be enough to make us pause and think, what can we do for that demographic?
Well, and they do use technology. You know, that's a misnomer that often comes up is, you know, we think of grandma sitting on the rocking chair. You know, surely she doesn't use Venmo, except she has found that, you know, that's a way to engage with her grandchildren, to send money and to use, you know, FaceTime is quite possibly the greatest driver of adoption of technology in the aging population ever. And if they can figure out FaceTime, they can probably figure about anything. You know, Brad, with your XVC hat on, do you see venture dollars maybe, you know, not looking at someone who's going to focus on the aging population with the same, you know, level of sexiness that you would say, oh, you're going to do a mobile first AI powered chatbot, you know, digital wallet? You know, that sounds sexy and cool. Doing something that supports aging sounds significantly less cool.
Well, you know, the thing about venture dollars moving into the space is that they see through digital technologies that you can serve everyone and that you don't have to have a segmented approach. So this idea that we're building for millennials and we're building for needs that are, you know, people just getting started in different financial services and their credit needs and, you know, the way that they save and invest, it's a misnomer to, like, you know, think that venture dollars are going to only support one area or one segment. I mean, this is something like that social networks, you know, look at for 2.5 billion people, and they're not going to create a messaging platform that just hit, you know, the 20 to 30 year olds. So why would fintech be any different?
Yeah. Well, in, you know, I think there's some unique needs this population has. And with that conversion that Theo was describing, that, you know, the number of people going over the age of 65 and a number of things happening both in your financial life and your health life that occur, then you do need actually new tools and ones you probably don't have access to today. You know, what sorts of techs are you looking at within unconventional ventures that you think are going to play unique roles for the aging population?
So I actually want to go back to that one point when we're talking about different tools. I wouldn't necessarily say different tools, but different applications of it.
Yep.
Right. So, for example, we think about AI, right? It's a shiny new toy that everyone is talking about, but exactly what it means and how do we apply it? Well, it depends on who you talk to. And so when we think about AI and financial planning, for example, you can think about, you know, using it for some of the PFM tools that people have to help them save money. But what if we can expand the scope of it and not just help one individual save money, but help them rethink finances, not just for their own household, but also for their aging parents and also for, you know, the future of their children's education, right? So, you know, startup companies like Pathin that's based in New York, and that's exactly what they're thinking about, is how do we leverage technology but expand it to think multi-generational needs? And that's what's exciting.
And I love the multi-generational, but that immediately made me think, you know, the number of times you hear the stat thrown out about the amount of wealth shift we're going to see from one generation to the other. But, you know, kind of like you had said, Theo, that you're aging from the minute you're born, there has been a generational wealth shift from, you know, the time the first, you know, stone axe was handed down to the daughter or son. You know, we've seen this going on, you know, for a very long time. I actually think the needs and where it gets really interesting is that population you talked about that has a different set of needs, because who really cares about their money? Well, one, it's people who have money, and who really, you know, pays closer attention to it are those who only have money flowing out if they're retired and they're expecting to live longer and have new sorts of bills. And then the last thing is, you know, who cares about digital? Well, what about the person for whom it is physically painful to maybe go into the branch, or because they're hard of hearing, doing telephone actually can be quite difficult. So everything you described, the idea of an older person interacting with the technology, that's where I see the real opportunities and some that are focused on. What gets you most excited, Brad?
Well, I'm going to go back again and say, it's great to see that companies are embracing things like voice in order to have conversations between someone's personal information and finance and their needs. Or it's great to see companies like Honest combining the ability digitally for a conversation between generations about their wealth, or a company like Honest extending into Golden for financial caregiving, or we're looking at companies that are enabling the monitoring of financial transactions so that you can make sure that, you know, your parents aren't being scammed somehow. I think it's necessary for us to acknowledge that this wealth transfer of trillions of dollars, while it's something that has been handed down like an axe, it's something that has changed because we're changing as a society, right? So we're the fastest growing group of workers is the 65 to 74 year olds. Mm-hmm. And when we think about the way that wealth has changed, it's changed because, you know, we're a strong economic engine within this country, but we're not an equitable engine in terms of wage increases and other opportunities to grow that wage growth. So these type of companies are helping us sustain wealth and being able to help people as they age, retain that wealth and start to decumulate that wealth, and have the rest of the family be involved in those type of decisions. Because again, it's important for us to sort of shepherd generation to generation so that we're not losing what is a shrinking middle class and the opportunity that surrounds it.
Yeah, I think that's an important point too, because I remember I was on a panel a couple of months ago and we talked about the very same thing, and a banker turned and looked at me. He's like, I'm not interested in old people. That's literally what he said in the panel. And it was fascinating because if you think about it, a lot of financial institutions, a lot of their current customers are the people that have wealth, are the older generation. And so it's dumbfounding that they would just say, well, you know, I am just going to ignore the people who are my customers, who are holding a lot of assets in my bank. But instead, I'm going to start running after the offspring and the people that are going to be, quote unquote, handed down the wealth. My question is,
Theo, let's face it, the conferences targeting the aging population are not nearly as interesting and as exciting as going to Money 2020 or Finovate and the shiny objects that are, you know, used there.
Well, it's not, but, you know, here is a different way for them to rethink positioning, right? If you say you are interested in millennials, so take the recent Charles Schwab report that came out, you know, that was looking at the quote-unquote younger adults and what they're thinking about. The demographics that they surveyed, the group, they say 81% of that group have witnessed their family going through financial hardship. And so my question is, okay, so if you want to be helpful to those younger kids, if you want to earn their trust, if you want them to be your customer, instead of putting a robot in the branch and tell them, hey, we are so cool, you need to come, how about be helpful to their family? How about be helpful to their parents and grandparents that they witness that are going through financial hardship, right?
Well, and one thing, Brad, that you said that resonates with what Theo's just describing is the old playbook doesn't really work anymore. The idea of you work to a certain age, you retire, you have, as long as you have a certain amount of money or a pension, and your children live nearby, and that's what you can count on for assistance, whether it's physical or with your finances. You know, now that we're talking about families living all over the globe and how they interact and what that kind of hardship that Theo was just describing around, wow, it's a lot more expensive to buy a house. How are you going to afford that down payment? Or the number of people, whether they're older or younger, working in a gig economy, the rules on how the generations work together have changed pretty dramatically as well.
Well, I mean, we're living longer. The boomer generation, like said, hey, we're going to suck the marrow out of the entire economy and we're going to work until we drop. But the challenge continues to be that we're seeing, you know, Americans, two-thirds of which don't have a budget. When we look at retirement, you know, the average boomer has less than a third of boomers have less than $25,000 in any kind of retirement savings. That's why they're working to their 75 or older. Americans on average retire with only $85,000 in savings. That's insane. So you need to understand that the bigger challenges within the economy are going to be with this huge shift, and financial service firms of all types have to be part of this. This is why I get excited when I see Acorns and Robinhood and others getting people to invest early. Because you could have $250,000 in student debt, be in your mid-20s, and start to sock away the right amount of money until you're 40 and still end up with $5 million. That's going to be something that you can not only live on, but that's something that's going to be intergenerationally being able to transfer to the generation next. So we need to rethink what retirement is, and we need to rethink the way that financial service firms approach this market.
Theo, who, when you look at the incumbent players, are there any standouts that you think are doing particularly well as they think about the needs of either the aging population or the multi-generational aspect of it?
I've been very impressed with what U.S. Bank has been doing. I've partnered with them on, you know, hackathons, and, you know, we've been working together for the last few years. And they are very, how do I say it, realistic in a way. You know, they understand that as financial institutions, you need to think about the future. You need to think about how to capture the market. You need to think about using technologies and all their wonderful shiny new toys. That's what they run in the innovation lab. But at the same time, they're also very cognizant about how do they better serve the current demographics and how do they help them resolve challenges. So, you know, that one definitely stands out for me.
Yeah, well, and I would say you hit something important there that I think U.S. Bank does particularly well is their innovation efforts always tend to be very outcome-based and very targeted on understanding a real customer pain point that they're going to use the innovation for. I think, Brad, it was you earlier in the show had said, you know, let's not just jump to the technologies, or actually, Theo, I think it was you. Let's not just jump to the technologies. It's about the applications of the technologies that's going to make it interesting. Are there certain application areas either of you are more excited about than the others?
Well, I mean, fraud, yeah.
Yeah.
Fraud. You both say that. Jinx, you're silent for the rest of the show.
No. So what in particular about fraud, outside of the fact that, you know, there's an ever-increasing sort of targeting of people that are, say, over the age of 60 in terms of their financial transactions, right? There's all types of fraud that companies like Eversafe are protecting us from. But what I'm most interested in is, you know, why we think of those type of transactions as being, you know, targeted to people that maybe are paying a little bit less attention. The challenge, I think, is for companies to look at how we integrate that within traditional banks. You know, why do we need startups to sit there and protect and monitor? We should be integrating these type of startups and their ideas within the system itself. Because yeah, it's not just, protection for one segment, it's protection for all.
I agree. Each episode, you know, with that particular demographic, each time they lose at the minimal $120,000. And so
crazy.
That's a loss, not just for the financial institution, but also for their customer. And if you think about it, a lot of these are preventable, right? A lot of times how that happens is the fraudsters, they target seniors because they know they're lonely. You start making a phone call to them and, you know, it becomes a habit. So this strange person is calling me every day, but they're willing to stay on the phone for a whole hour. And next thing you know, that person becomes a friend. And next thing you know, they start writing checks to them. And it's so frequently happening. My question is, why aren't our systems catching it? There was a really good article that talked about it in New Yorker recently. And is this woman described the exact same thing that happened and multiple times to financial institutions saw something happens, they raised the flag, and then they said, oh, well, okay, we'll let it go. And so my question is, it's not just the fact that we have the technology, we're not using it, we also have the process, but they're not doing it properly, and we also have the human checkpoint. So it's multiple points of failure, and that happens on a daily basis.
And meanwhile, Theo, Zelle believes that me transferring money between two accounts that I own that both have my name on it is somehow suspicious because I've done it 3 months in a row. But, you know, transferring money to a total stranger, you know, that's easy peasy. Well, mm-hmm. And along that line, I saw a local newscast that was actually on this idea of faster payments bring up the idea that it actually is making fraud easier. And it was particularly pointed at the aging population that might not be as savvy about this in terms of who that friend request is. Do you think there's anything to the idea that faster payments like a Zelle or a Venmo or even a faster ACH is somehow promoting more fraud, particularly in this demo?
There's always been plenty of fraud in this space, and there's been just as much fraud with, you know, writing checks as there have been in digital payments. I think that the challenge more is in the tools and recognizing what is legitimate and what is not. And to your point about, you know, doing the Zelle transfer between two accounts you own, I think that systems need to be backed up with humans. And we need to look at these systems as not just being in compliance, but we're talking about, on the aggregate, trillions of dollars at stake in terms of what we protect. And so the industry is based on that trust. And so we need to continue to evolve our tools as the ability to move larger and larger sums of money become commonplace.
Yeah. So what other startups? You've mentioned some really good ones, like, you know, Acorns promoting more savings, Honest. What other ones do you like that you think are doing interesting things?
So along the line, I think Brad mentioned it earlier, Eversafe, that they do fraud detection using machine learning and AI, and they do partner with some financial institutions. So I think what they're doing is very, very important. And along the same line, what I like a lot of times with these startups is they all have a personal story, right? And that's also what pains me, is these people, you know, and it's a pretty wide demographics, if you will, of startup founders, that they witness either their parents or families, their grandparents, all going through similar episodes. And they all raise the same question: why aren't we doing more? Why isn't financial services industry doing more, right? So Eversafe, they started because of that way. Pepin, that I mentioned earlier, that helped with AI financial planning, they started that way because she was helping her father going through his finances when he was getting ready to retire. Golden, that focused on some financial caregiving, same thing. You know, the founder started it because of his family going through bills when they went through an episode in the hospital. And Honest, Brad is doing amazing things with family financial management. And one area I do like to see more, that I wish there's more, is what Brad mentioned earlier, decumulation, right? We have a lot of financial advisors out there that are helping their clients who are able to afford their services, who are able to think about, this is the bulk of the assets that I have, and this is how much I'm going to start drawing down for the next 20 plus years, so I know I will not run out of money in my later years. What about the people that cannot afford human advisors? What about the people that own less than $100,000 that they're trying to figure out how to make ends meet in the last 20 years of their life? I would love to see more services that can target towards those
and there's,
and help,
you know,
them make better decisions.
I was just going to say there's a lot of, you know, wealth advisory platforms that will help you understand the impact of Social Security, the impact of, you know, say if you had some form of personal pension from your employer. But companies need to do a better job of creating those opportunities for people as they age. You know, a company like Blueprint Capital is sort of re-envisioning annuities in a digital format to create, you know, what in essence is a personal pension, to amend what other benefits and you have from Social Security and other forms, and also your savings through your 401k and other. And so when you look at, again, the way that banks should be looking at this space, it's more so, how do we reinvent CDs? How do we reinvent day-to-day savings that build up opportunities like a Robinhood would to be able to do investments? How do we look at marginal and fractional investments in order to own part of Amazon as it goes from zero to 10,000? These are really critical things that need to start earlier and earlier, or else we're going to have even a huger, like larger explosion of issues that are going to be happening in the next several decades. Banks need to be a part of this now.
Yeah. Well, and Brad, you're spot on that it isn't just about changing the user interface, right? It's not just about a digital UI. It's about fundamentally rethinking how does new technology allow us to fundamentally rethink what is the product and how does it get delivered. I love the Blueprint example where you can have something completely customized, a financial product that meets your exact needs because, you know, it can put those pieces together when you tell it what inputs you have.
Well,
do you see any?
Yeah, just think about something very, very, very basic, right? What do we do with bank profits now that they've recovered and gone above record profits from 10 years ago? Right? We're still not doing anything in terms of a rate, you know, give back of any kind. We're starting to see savings rates creep up just a little bit. Certificate rates between, you know, 1% and 2% for 5+ years. we really need to rethink how banks are giving back to their customers for what they get in return. The spreads are still at 4+5% in terms of net interest margin. We're talking about very, very low cost of funds, and there's a battle for deposits. Let's start giving something back for that.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, now is the time. It's easy to say, oh, record profits, keep taking record profits. Now is exactly the time they should be investing in the future and fundamentally rethinking parts of how the model could work. When you're on your heels because, you know, profits are down and new technologies enabling new entrants or entrants like the Amazons are coming in or someone that's a financial caregiver can offer products like these, you know, that's a very dangerous time where you start throwing Hail Marys in your innovation efforts. Do you have other examples of either larger institutions or startups that are fundamentally rethinking the product and the delivery?
Well, you know, you have to combine the entire picture. I think one of the ones that have always stood out to me is like a USAA that has combined insurance and financial services and the long-term aggregate view. I think that they were very early on to recognize that, yeah, maybe early efforts in terms of aggregating your finances together to look at the larger picture didn't necessarily relate to profits 10 years ago when PFM and other type of tools started. But they stuck to it, right? They continue to offer that aggregated view throughout the past decade, even though there's been ups and downs in terms of how you access that data, how many, you know, type of data providers there are for them to partner with in order to gain access. What I think is most important about what they've done is that they haven't given up in terms of providing the customer the insight about not just their financial standing, but where the future intersection of their needs are going to go into. So I'd like to see a lot more of what we're seeing with direct banks, with Marcus and with Erica and other opportunities that Bank of America and Chase and others are doing with direct banks to actually leverage that day-to-day understanding of your financial needs and help coach people from a young age to better use of credit, to better savings opportunities, to actual start to invest. We still have far too few customers that are directly investing into the market for those long-term gains.
I'm starting to see some of the financial institutions that even though they owned wealth management firms and they were banks themselves, they ran them so separately and siloed, they finally woken up to this idea that in a regulatory sense or within the structure of the FI itself, they might seem like really different things. But to the individual, money is money. And they've started to actually figure out how do we leverage, not just by giving an aggregated view like you were saying, but actually leverage the fact that, you know, I can hold your wealth and I can have your spend account. How do I actually begin to merge those things? I think Personal Capital is doing some pretty interesting stuff on that front that's, you know, very tech driven, but also very integrated. Theo, any rising stars for you?
No, I think you guys hit it on the nail. What I read something earlier this week and that resonates as well. I'm starting to see, like you say, a few more folks thinking about it in that direction is instead of pushing products, right? Products in the traditional sense, here's a savings account, here's a checking account. We need to reposition and think about how do people look at money? What is our relationship with money? How do we look at finances? Right. And then offer services and solutions around that. I think that in itself will be, you know, more useful because the way we live our lives is different. So the way we manage our money should be different.
Well, and so, you know, in the closing minutes, it's part of what Unconventional Ventures is looking to do, you know, without being too much of an advertisement. I'd love for you to share with the audience, you know, what is Unconventional? What services are you providing as firms are getting their heads around this?
So we wanted to call it Unconventional, and Brad chime in, is because we are looking at something different, right? We are not running after the shiny new toys. We are not running after the, you know, hey, everyone is running after the same demographic, so let's do that too. Part of our mission is that we want to connect founders with funders that are serving an underserved demographics, right? That come from different corners of the society, because there is so much emphasis and spotlight being cast on specific groups that we feel that great ideas can basically come from anywhere. And we personally, you know, in the last few years have seen a lot of amazing people with great ideas that they just need a little bit of lift, a little bit of help. And so, you know, that's with that in mind that we wanted to do something good with the knowledge that we have, with the network and connections that we have, so we can work with different brands and organizations to help them understand how do we leverage that innovation, the technology, the bright minds of the people, and address financial services markets and look at what are the gaps between what they're doing right now and the future models.
Well, not only is it doing good, I think you guys will do well at it, both with your background and everything we've talked about. It's time for a short break, but thank you, Theo and Brad from Unconventional Ventures joining us. And right after the break, we're going to have two exciting startups. One, actually, that Theo had introduced me to back when she was running the ARP Startup Challenge, Silverbills, and then have Rianne from Kinder as well. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the second half of the show of Breaking Banks. Excited to have another Chicagoan on, Heather Holmes, co-founder and CEO of Genivity, and really going after one of the most interesting and challenging areas when we talk about aging, and that is the intersection of health and wealth. And so welcome to the show, Heather. Would love if you could tell us a little bit about the problem that you're going after and how you're solving it.
Yeah, thank you, Jason, so much for having me on your show. Genivity stands for generations and longevity. And what we really truly believe is that for too long, the way we've thought about health has been set in its own little healthcare silo, separated from wealth, which has been in its silo. And if you think about it, the two go hand in hand and really belong together. And so what we do at Genivity is we make it really easy for financial planners to be able to understand how different types of health risks can impact a plan and really impact a client's longevity so that they're able to personalize planning based on these risks and potential costs, which was something that really shocked my co-founder and I. We both come from the healthcare industry, and we were just very surprised with all the different types of forecasting that is done in a financial plan, how there really was none being done when you're thinking about longevity, healthcare costs, or elder care costs. And so what we do is we bring science, the science behind those risks into it, but make it so simple that the advisor has the numbers they need to plan.
And how many advisors are sophisticated enough to know how to interpret that and to bake it into the plan? Because far too often advisors really, at least in my experience playing in the wealth space, they focus on, you know, returns, and then, you know, some will get into the planning of you need to put more away, and they kind of stop there and they don't necessarily take this whole holistic view. Do you find they're receptive when you actually bring the tools to them that you can actually help solve that?
Well, Jason, I think it's actually a two-part thing. So the first is any advisor who's a CFP, does planning. So anybody who does planning, really, this is part of their requirements and obligation is to be having these conversations. And when you think about it, if these are some of the biggest chunks that are going to impact a client's retirement plan and you're not planning for that, you have to wonder what kind of exposure of risk that you're putting yourself at as well as the client by not having those conversations. But here's the thing. It's the beauty of our product HALO, which stands for Health Analysis and Longevity Optimizer, is that it's designed to be client-facing. So the advisor shares HALO with their clients. We've designed it in a way that's very easy for anybody to be able to go through and answer and assess in the privacy of their own home or side-by-side with their advisor if their advisor chooses. And then we give the advisor the output, which is really focused on the numbers. And advisors know what to do with those numbers. It's not requiring them to have to go and introduce those conversations. But I think like the third piece that I would just throw out there really quick is that advisors are not getting paid to just manage the assets anymore. They need to be able to broaden their approach and show more value to the clients. And this is one of the top things that we know that pre-retirees are concerned about, especially high net worth pre-retirees. So this is a key way for that advisor to differentiate and talk about the things that matter to their client.
Well, in that point you made earlier in the show, you know, we had taken part in some research. I think it still holds true. When I was at Perk Street, it's the number one concern Americans have, it was 87% of them either
strongly agreed, or it was their number one item, was running out of money. And, you know, as you said, you know, health is such a wild card there in terms of knowing if you have enough and how do you actually plan for it. And I'm curious, what actually led you to start thinking about this? You had mentioned that both you and Emily, who's your co-founder and chief data scientist, you come from the health side. You know, was there an event for one of you, or what made you start going after this area?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we both have our stories about it, but my side of healthcare, and I'll try and tell it very briefly, was, I started in sales, but I spent most of my career in market development. So helping to grow physician practices and hospital systems and the referral patterns. It's a similar problem. Physicians are not very good at referrals and growing their business, similar as this is something advisors always want to do. And one of the things that I found was that if you talk to the individual or the family around their risk and how they can do things to live longer and healthier together, they become very loyal and you get more referrals from within the family. So this is something I scaled up globally and then realized that to truly make an impact, it needed to not be in the hospital. It needed to be a technology in the hands of that end family. And it needed to show the financial impact of waiting to make these decisions because people would still put off the decisions. We all know we should exercise more, eat better, drink less, but we still do what we do. But if you can frame that into increasing your longevity or reducing risk, and most importantly, reducing costs, people care about what hits their pocketbook. So that was really it. My co-founder, she's a computational geneticist out of Stanford, where she did her PhD and her postdoc. Then she was working over at 23andMe on the health side, where she realized that there was a much broader impact you could have when you're looking at the broader family, that genetics was just a small piece of that puzzle. And so that's really how we came together to make Genevity be something that'd be very impactful.
Well, you bring up another interesting point when you say together, and part of the platform is really around information sharing. Can you talk a little bit about that and how you serve the multi-generational aspect? Earlier in the show, had Theo Lau, who I know you know as well, and Brad Limer. And that's one of the things that we spend a lot of time talking about. It isn't just about building technology for the aging, but it's also for helping the family manage the aging process.
Absolutely. And helping the advisor be that quarterback to the family and helping them. So, I mean, the numbers are staggering, right? We are in this great wealth transfer with $30 trillion changing hands between family members. And frankly, advisors are, not looking too good on that side, with 70% of the time the widow firing the advisor within 18 months of their husband passing away. And traditionally, just if you look at longevity, the man will tend to pass first. And even if the advisor is able to keep the account with her, 90% of the time, the adult children will leave when they get their inheritance. And when you really drill down into the why is that the advisor has not shown the value to that non-financial decision-making spouse or the adult children. So when it comes time for those decisions to be made, it's too late. So, well, families can be really funny about talking about money, and everybody has their own things about what they feel comfortable sharing. There's a universal, and that is that everybody cares about the health and well-being of their loved ones. And that chief medical officer of the family, the woman, or the adult children, the research shows their top fears are caring for their loved one and making sure that they're okay. So what we do is we help or now after they've put these plans into place, bring the broader conversation in with the rest of the family so that everyone's on the same page and the advisor becomes that trusted resource for them.
I mean, absolutely. There was other research that I've seen where it is actually more often easier for parents will talk with their children about sex before they would choose to talk about money with their children. It's just so interesting in our culture that which one is more taboo than the other and just how hard that can be. Now, do you have any thing that you've learned when you look at working with these advisors that you say, yep, this is how we are really a great tech enabler to them in terms of how you power their practice?
Yeah, I think some of the best feedback that we've gotten is that what this does is it uncovers blind spots in the plan. And whether that's blind spots that haven't been addressed or planned for yet, or blind spots with the client where maybe they haven't been willing to take action yet. And so what this does is we personalize everything to the individual, to that client. So it's not some generic average. It's very personalized based on them and their risk. And so, and we frame it in a totally different way. So it's not just about the things of how long will you live or how much will out-of-pocket care costs or elder care costs be, but it's also framing in a good way of how many healthy years should you make sure that you're planning for all the activities you're doing. Because it's all about like, how are you going to manage the decumulation? And if you know that you're going to have 25 really active, healthy years in retirement, you want to make sure that you're still able to do all those things in those go-go years before you enter into those slow-go and later no-go years when you're facing elder care. So what we really want to do is help people and the advisor be able to plan for those best things. And what this does is illustrate it in a way that really helps them think about how do they want to enjoy their retirement.
Now, as a startup and you're often aging in the elder population is not considered, you know, the sexiest place to be playing in, do you feel like there is, you know, discrimination might be a strong word for it, but when you talk to a lot of, you know, the other investors or fintech startups that are doing the latest shiny object, you know, AI blockchain in the cloud bots, and, you know, you're going after solving real fundamental hard needs, but for an aging population, do you feel like you're looked down upon sometimes in the fintech community?
I would say absolutely not, for two reasons. First of all, everything that we've built is building out these intelligent recommendations, building out that AI recommendations to the advisor so that they can better engage with the family. So that's a key part of the backbone of our technology. And the science is pretty sexy behind what we do as well. But the second thing is, just like I was saying, for every advisor, this is something inevitable they're going to face with every single client. Pretty much any investor that we've been engaging with, you can see them get taken aback as they have gone through this situation with their parents recently, or they might be going through it right now. And it actually triggers a very emotional response. Male or female, it doesn't matter. But when you're that person and now you're facing that with your own parents, you realize just how lonely and lost and how critical it is to have a plan in place early and to be able to, from a financial perspective, mitigate some of that risk out of your assets or out of it, out of the account, so that it doesn't decimate the plan.
Yeah. So you recently released some news, and we don't often ask about, you know, clients if they aren't public, but it is public now that you're partnering with BMO Harris. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what was the partnering process like as you started to engage with them?
Yeah, so we are thrilled to be partnering with BMO Wealth Management and have just found them to be very forward-thinking around innovation when it comes to banking and their wealth management practice. And they really realize that the key trends that we've just been talking about, that health and longevity are big concerns that need to be personalized and should be personalized as part of the plan. But then also it very much aligns with it, with their missions and their vision, a vision of being able to better engage with the household and provide that value that they know the household's going to need at some point. So we had the opportunity to early on get to work with them in a bit of get some mentorship from some of their wealth management group. And so they're very instrumental in providing early feedback to us about our product and how we could make it even more valuable to their advisors. And then we were thrilled that they were very aggressively wanting to take this out and take it to market with both sides of their planning services, with their private bank, as well as with BHFA, which is their financial advisory group, because they see that it doesn't matter about what level of wealth you have. This is a universal concern and need that people have and that they need to plan for.
Absolutely. And it's one where technology is so important because it's very easy to throw bodies at it that are doing, you know, all sorts of scenarios that are manually driven and do all sorts of real-time monitoring with the staff when you're talking about the top 1%, but how do we scale that for the other 99%? And if the banks aren't doing it, you know someone else is going to come along and start to work on that problem themselves.
Absolutely. And what's really impressed us is that they really want to be able to do the right thing for their clients. And that's why they, you know, that they've just very much embraced this.
So we're almost out of time, but I'd love if you could take the last 2 minutes. Do you have any insights you could share about how do you improve your chances of success as a startup partnering with an incumbent financial institution? I realize you probably could do an entire episode on that, but would love 2 minutes of wisdom.
Yeah, you know, for us, we've just been there. What we didn't realize when we first came out to market was that this was going to be such a resounding hot topic with other enterprise financial institutions. And so for us, it's really been about selecting as well. Who do we think are the ones who really embrace and understand what we're doing and want to partner with us for those good reasons? So for us, we love working with enterprise customers, and we have some others. But I think it's all about setting the expectation and finding the right people to work together with. And I think for us, that's going to be our key to success, along with continuing to build more of those relationships.
So how early did you engage with the risk and compliance folks? If you're talking about setting up for success, is it more important to have the business leader, or do you need to solve some of those other burning questions first?
Well, I would actually say they're both. So first, I think going back to my co-founders, our background in healthcare, we take security and compliance very seriously. And so we made a lot of investments right out of the gate as a startup that later we've learned most startups don't do, but we always knew that that was the most important thing that our reputation would hang on. But going through the process, and we, like I said, with a couple enterprise customers to date, it has been very eye-opening to see what kind of diligence and work that they have to do. And I personally am so proud of our CTO and what he delivered on from a security and compliance standpoint that they've said could stand the test of time with anyone. So I think you just have to be willing to do the right work and to listen and to do it early, because then it just opens the doors everywhere else. I think if we would have started with a different model and started with purely with smaller firms and then tried to then flip to working with enterprises, it would have been really difficult because we probably would have built our products in a totally different way.
Yeah, there are no shortcuts when it comes to the security and compliance. Well, thank you, Heather Holmes, CEO and co-founder of Genivity, for joining us today. You know, maybe we will actually see each other face to face one of these days in Chicago. But thank you for making the time.
Thank you, Jason. I appreciate it. Take care.
Today, really excited to have Marcy Lobel Esrick, who is the founder and general counsel of Silverbills. And I had the great pleasure of getting to know her when she was going through the AARP's program that was looking at technology providers that can help the aging population. And Marcy, really excited to have you here. You know, I'm a huge fan of your work and the problem you're looking to solve. I would love for you to tell a little bit of the history of the founding of Silverbills, because it's so fascinating how you found your way into being a tech entrepreneur.
Thank you, Jason, and thank you so much for inviting me to participate today. I really appreciate that. So basically, I was a lawyer for 20 years doing the typical corporate job, and I was working for the New York Mets parent company, Sterling Equities, when the Madoff fiasco broke and the company lost about $500 million, as well as almost the whole 401k of the company. And my job description changed significantly, and I really became somewhat of an expert in financial exploitation. And at the same time, my elderly aunt was aging in her home, and her daughters lived across the country. And she was really struggling with this job of bill paying. And I realized that at the intersection of those two issues, financial exploitation and bill paying for the elderly, there were a lot of vulnerabilities that needed addressing. And because, as we've talked in the past, bill paying can often be a portal to identity theft and financial exploitation. So I did a lot of research and study into the issue of bill paying for the elderly, and I found out that there was no transparent technology solution. And so started really developing the concept of silver bills and have been working on it since then, which was approximately 2.5 to 3 years ago.
Well, and explain a little bit how silver bills works, because it's a great application in terms of the elegance of it. Simple, easy to use, but really gets to the heart of the problem.
Sure. So right now, if an individual is aging in his or her home, and by the way, that's going to be 80% of the population, will not move to any kind of institutional setting for a whole host of reasons, including financial, social, and desire to be near existing medical professionals. So 80% of the population who's aging in their home has to manage this process, and it's very, very fragmented. They're receiving bills, typically with this population, it's paper bills from many, many different types of vendors, such as the phone company, the water company, real estate taxes, you know, you name it, it's coming typically in paper form. And there are a lot of different due dates to remember and checks to write. And even if people are getting things in PDF form or online, it's still a very cumbersome process to manage. So once a client enrolls with Silver Bills, we interface directly with the vendors to instruct them, pursuant to our service agreement, to send all of that documentation directly to Silver Bills in whatever form they can provide it in, whether it's paper, electronic, et cetera. And we receive it all. We scrutinize it pursuant to reasonable and customary historical parameters. We store it in a safe online secure file cabinet, and we ensure that it's paid correctly and on time.
Now, I love that, you know, there both is the identity theft, the safety, security, but I'll be honest, if someone could be doing this for me, you know, I hate paper bills and things that were electronic suddenly because they bounce, become a paper again, and I ignore them. Can you share? Well, I mean, you have some fascinating case studies of the impact that you've been able to have on some lives. Can you share some of those?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really fundamental and personal problem. And we have on our Facebook page a horrifying example of about a month ago in New Jersey. This was not a client, obviously, but someone who literally passed away because her electricity was turned off because she didn't have the wherewithal to pay her electric bill, and she was using oxygen tanks. And this doesn't have to happen. We had a client in that exact scenario, but we were able to work with the electric company and prevent that from happening. We've literally prevented people from being evicted. And really, it goes on and on, because often it's not, and we're not talking about the financial capacity to pay a bill right now. I'm talking about the wherewithal, because when you think of the steps involved in making sure that your electric bill is paid, and that you've looked at it, and that you have a copy of it, and you send it, put a stamp, write it out, it's sometimes just too much for individuals, whatever stage of life. I mean, you know, you referenced yourself, you know, this has potential uses for all different populations. We've decided, you know, to devote ourselves to the elderly because we see a great need in that sphere, but it's really universal. And it's a way to outsource to a trusted third party. And so in the cases that we've helped people, you know, it's just been a tremendous impact on the individual lives of our clients.
So often within financial services, especially, we talk about the millennials and the digital natives. Have you found any difference in well, I'm sure it is different, but how have you found the experience of producing technology for an aging and older population? And have you had to make any special accommodations as you've thought about that?
So to be honest, I would say over 80% of our clients do not really use technology. So we're talking about almost a disenfranchised population, because imagine all of the cultural references in our current world to online, whatever it is, you know, and this population, you know, in many cases doesn't have that, you know, ability to reference. So we really have a special sensitivity when dealing with our clients, and we really empower them to access technology without having to be direct users. So, you know, that being said, our whole interface, et cetera, is just very, very simple. Instead of having, for example, 10 different logins for your phone company, your electric company, your water company, et cetera, there's one. It's all accessible, you know, at silverbills.com with one login and one, password. Everything's in very simple files that can be viewed, from either the client or if the client provides written authorization. For example, we work with a lot of tax preparers, so they love us because instead of having their clients, have to come up with actual documents in order to finalize tax preparation, they can grant us the ability to share that with their accountants and CPAs. So it's very, very simple. The whole concept is very simple. And I think that that's useful for this population, but really for anyone.
Yeah, I was just going to say, if you could simplify now my tax prep as well as pay all of my bills, this is a win-win. I will become your youngest customer. So I think it's interesting that so not many are knowing that they're using the technology, or most of the interfaces outside of a traditional UX. Do you provide a lot of phone or other support then to compensate for that?
We do, but yes. I mean, customer service is really key for this population. The other issue is they continue to get their monthly, their typical checking statement, which, they can see and look at. That doesn't change. But yes, that being said, we are available to our clients with any questions, and we have, customer service reps, especially trained to manage this particular population.
So I'm curious, do you face any age discrimination in the sense of like, what, you're a startup that works for the aging population, not the latest, mobile first millennial thing? Do people kind of look at you funny when you talk about who your customers are?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it's not considered a very sexy space, but for me, it's really, really exciting because, as we talked earlier, this the demographics are just incredibly persuasive. I mean, this is where our country is heading. And I believe that businesses that are focusing on this population are in a very, very exciting space.
You had mentioned to me earlier a study or a report. I'll put that out in social, but could you maybe talk about what's in it? Because it is such an interesting demo and an exciting growth one. It's an exciting set of new needs, if not a typically sexy one.
Yes, it was produced by the Milken Institute, the Center for the Future of Aging. And the title of it is Silver to Gold, The Business of Aging. It's the report from the Summit on Business and the Future of Aging by Paul Irving. And it was published in 2018. So it's a very recent report. And I would point anyone who's interested in the space to review that because it provides a lot of very valuable information and data.
Well, I know how I'm going to be spending my evening after we finish the show is downloading and taking a look at that. Before we wrap up, we're almost to the end here. Where can people find out more about you? What's the easiest place to hear some of your fascinating stories?
Oh, thank you. Really, silverbills.com. There's a wealth of information there. Anyone who's interested in specifically speaking with me can just feel free to email me directly at marcy@silverbills.com. And, I think that I really appreciate the opportunity to get the word out about what we're doing.
Well, you have a fascinating company and glad you could take some time out to join us. This is Marcy Lavelle Esrig of Silverbills. Thanks. That's it for this week. Thanks to Brad, Theo, Heather, and Marcy for joining us. Some exciting shows coming up, including Workhorses versus Unicorns, looking at fintech and venture capital, and Out of Africa, where we talk to some innovators across the Atlantic. We appreciate the feedback and suggestions. Hit us up on Twitter at BreakingBanks1 or info@provoke.fm. If you're interested in sponsoring a show or a segment, just drop us a line. Before you jump to the next podcast, don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform. And also, you can listen to all of our more than 200 shows, plus episodes from my FinTech 5 podcasts, Serial Entrepreneur by JP Nichols, and Breaking Banks Asia Pacific with Simon Spencer, all at provoke.fm. That's it, folks. See you next week on more Breaking Banks.